button. Great. All right. Today is January 13th, 2015, and with me on the phone today is Chuck Zemach. And Chuck, can you spell for me your name?
Z-E-M-A-C-H.
And your first name?
Charles.
Thank you.
And it's usually pronounced Zemach.
Okay, Zemach. And my name is Tom Martin. And we're interviewing Chuck today about his experiences in Grand Canyon. Chuck, what year were you born?
I was born in 1930.
Where?
September 15th. That makes me 84 currently.
Okay. Where were you born?
I was born in Los Angeles, and my family moved to New York City when I was 3 years old, and then I grew up there.
What
you
did
want
your...
me to continue with this?
Yeah, well, what did your parents do?
Well, my parents, they both came from Russia. They were in a theatrical troupe, which was founded by my father in Moscow in the turbulent times during the Bolshevik Revolution. And they then, in the 1920s, had permission from the Soviet government to tour throughout Europe, and when they got to Paris finally, they decided not to go back. And then they eventually made their way to America.
Wow.
I remember one story told by my mother. My father had written to a friend in Moscow. This was in 1926. And he asked them, "What was it, how are things going in Russia, and would the friend advise them to return?" And the friend said, wrote back in a letter, "If you think it's a good idea to go to hell to light a cigarette, then by all means come back."
Wow.
So those were turbulent times. Actually, my father spent some time in jail for being... This was a Hebrew a theater group and emphasizing the Hebrew language. And that wasn't politically correct in the early days of the Soviet regime, and he eventually got out and then made his way to America.
So you grew up in New York City then?
I grew up in New York City. I went to high school there, Stuyvesant High School, and after that I went to college. Went to college in 1947. And that was Harvard College. And then I was living in Cambridge, Mass. For a while. And I never came back to New York.
Okay. Did you do any outing activities away from the city when you were growing up?
Well, yes. I mean, on the one hand, you could say that New York City is a pretty urban area, and one can wonder whether one has any wilderness experiences or natural environment experiences. But in fact, all the people who could would go off for the summer for a vacation of some sort. I went to summer camp in the Catskills in Lower New York, and I also, for some reason, I had asthma when I was a child, and I was parked on a farm in the Catskill Mountains for several years in 1935 or 6 and so forth. So Catskill is pretty tame compared to Western Mountains, but it's rolling hills and beautiful country, and I had a little buddy of my own age. We were about 6 or 7 at the time, 5 or 6, and we used to run around, and we just enjoyed the wild countryside. I mean, it wasn't wild, but it was countryside.
Yeah.
We had a favorite sport. We would go tree climbing. And in the area around the farmhouse where we lived, we knew all the trees that were climbable, and we would make a round of them and climb them. And then later on, during high school, my father died when I was 9. That was in 1939. So I was living with my mother after that. And we would go to Lake Placid for summers. And she would leave me at Lake Placid when she had to return home for work. And this was in the summer, and there's Lake Placid and Mirror Lake and canoeing, and the Adirondack Mountains. And I remember once climbing Mount McIntyre, which is the second highest mountain in New York State. And I can still remember the experience. It was a one-day trip, and Mount McIntyre is 5,112 feet high.
Wow.
Not too much by Western standards. But it was pretty good for a kid.
Did you swim? Did you learn how to swim there on Lake Placid?
I learned how to swim in this summer camp, and then I certainly spent an awful lot of time in the water. The daily activity was going to Mirror Lake was a better lake for skiing for swimming, and it was swim there almost every day. And then there was a canoe in this motel that we were staying in on Lake Placid, and so I did a lot of canoeing on the lake.
Nice.
So that was, and then let's see.
So could I say that water was not a something to fear, but water was fun.
Yeah, water was fun.
Okay.
And even from the urban depths of New York City, one gets out into the Adirondacks. That's beautiful country.
Hmm.
And so I learned a little bit about that.
And then
later on, we moved to, after school, eventually had a job in the University of California, Berkeley, in the physics department.
Okay, so slow down a minute, back up. You went to college in 1947. That was before you got to California, is that right?
That's right, 47 to 51 for college.
What did you study?
I spent a year bumming around Europe. I got a college fellowship, a so-called traveling fellowship, which I spent on my own in Europe, visiting as many countries as I could, and including some of North Africa.
What year was that?
That was 51 to 52.
Okay.
Summer of 51 to summer of 52.
What was your degree in, your undergrad?
I majored in physics, and then I got a PhD at Harvard in theoretical physics.
Okay.
I was in particle physics.
Okay.
And just to continue the biography, I spent a year, 56, 57, maybe 2 years at the University of Pennsylvania as an instructor. In those days, they still had that lowly rank, after which I had spent a summer in between those 2 years in California. I had driven out there with a friend of mine from Cambridge, and this friend had actually done his undergraduate training at Caltech, and he really knew the West. So we drove across the country, and he introduced me to all the many of the Western national parks. And so that was my introduction to the West.
Okay.
Which is a very good one. I sort of had a private guide to all sorts of national parks. I remember particularly Yosemite and the Tetons. My friend was a mountain climber, and he had climbed the Grand Teton, and he talked to me about that. He gave me a climbing lesson once. I never followed that up too far.
I'm curious to go back to the year that you spent in Europe, all the way down to Northern Africa.
Yeah.
Traveling on your own, I'm assuming staying in hostels, or what was, back in the early 50s?
Things were cheaper in those days.
Okay.
I had a $2,500 scholarship.
Okay.
It's called the Shaw Traveling Fellowship from Harvard College, because I did pretty well at Harvard. And so $2,500, and I spent a year on that, and that wasn't too bad. I concentrated on the cheap hotels.
Okay.
And there were a lot of cheap and run-down hotels available. And before I'd done that, I had written to the consulates of all the countries that I thought of visiting, which was most of Western Europe. But I got as far as Turkey and Greece. And they all had, they were all interested in American tourism at that time. So they would get lists of hotels. And so I could pick out the cheapest one. I remember I had a principle or a goal that I could spend not more than $1 a day for a night for a hotel and not more than $1 a meal for a restaurant. And some countries were a little more expensive and some for a little less. And those were the days when there was a flourishing black market in American money.
Hmm.
For example, in Austria, oh gosh, I think it's maybe I shouldn't have picked that example, but it's something like the official rate was 15 shillings to a dollar, and then the black market rate was 26 shillings to a dollar. And you had people. I bought a guidebook in America, which recommended a bank in New York City, which would sell money. So I bought a lot of money. I remember French francs were 300, I think, to a dollar, but the black market rate was 500. I'm not sure I'm accurate about those numbers, but that's how it goes.
What did you take away from that year traveling?
What did I take away? Well, I spent a very intense amount of time trying to learn languages.
Okay.
The language I had taken up in college was German, and that had given me an excellent reading ability in German. I remember I had something like 4,000 word cards, so I knew it had a vocabulary of at least 4,000 words. Then I got to Germany, and I found that I couldn't speak the common words. For example, I bought a motorcycle. Well, if you buy a motorcycle, then there are a lot of words about traveling.
That's
like,
right.
Like tires and brakes and carburetor and steering wheel and seats and gas stations and highways. I didn't know any of those words, but I learned them pretty quickly. By the time I was finished, I could on short conversations pass myself off as German.
Nice.
And then I spent another intense amount of time studying Italian and French.
Okay.
And in later years, I spent a number of years in Italy. So I got to be pretty good at speaking Italian and sort of halfway good at speaking French and quarter way at Spanish. So I remember I did make a point of learning how to count to 100 in every country's language in the language of each country that I visited. So I don't remember. I can't summarize it. But most of Western Europe and also but extending to Austria, which was then occupied by the French, the Americans, the British, and the Russians.
Hmm.
That was before the peace agreement for Austria and Yugoslavia and Greece and Turkey. And then Morocco, Algeria, and Tunisia.
Okay.
Which is where I had practiced speaking French. So I could sort of mumble along in French. I never got terribly good in that.
So how did that experience in Europe? Now it's 1955-ish, and you're in California. You're touring. You're in Yosemite, the Tetons.
Yeah.
Did you see any similarities there, or was it just, this is the American West, and I've never seen anything like it, and I guess I'm trying to see if there's a tie over here, knowing that now you live in Santa Fe, which I should have mentioned at the start of this interview.
Yeah.
So it does seem as though eventually, having traveled a good chunk of the world here, you've settled in the American West.
Yes. Well, the Rockies and the Sierras are beautiful mountains. There's nothing to beat the Alps, though. I had a motorcycle, and I spent a lot of time just driving backwards and forwards on all the small Austrian roads up the Austrian Alps and taking all the cable cars to the tops of the mountains and things like that. And that's pretty gorgeous stuff. The Tetons, the closest thing that comes to looking like Alps in this country.
Yeah. And so to the Tetons, that was in Yosemite, your first introduction. What year was that? Was that 1955?
That would be, let's see, when did it come out? 56.
Okay.
It was 56 when my friend and I took this automobile drive. This is after we had both spent a year as postdocs at MIT, and then we spent a summer visiting the Stanford Physics Department, and we drove out there, and then I flew back. And that was 56, yeah.
And did you see the Grand Canyon on that National Parks tour?
We passed by the north rim of the Grand Canyon, and we looked out at it, and I think we hiked a little bit down. That was my first view of the Grand Canyon, a day or so.
Okay.
Not much.
From the north rim?
Yes, from the north rim.
Okay, 1956. And so then where did you go?
In this car trip across the country?
No. I'm sort of thinking. Oh. You've done your postdoc at MIT in 55.
All right. Then I had a job at maybe it was only 1 year at the University of Pennsylvania. That's right. It was 1 year at the University of Pennsylvania. But previous to that year, I spent the summer driving out into the West and seeing California. I fell in love with the West. I was determined not to stay in dismal Philadelphia too long. and then I got a postdoc at the University of California, Berkeley, in theoretical physics.
Okay.
So, in a way, that was one of the first times that I sort of had either tenure at a job or a promise of tenure, and I walked away from it because I wanted something better. They wanted to keep me at the University of Pennsylvania, and so basically they offered me an assistant professorship with pretty much a promise of eventual associate and full professorship there. But I turned that down in order to get a postdoc at UC Berkeley because I decided at that time that Berkeley was really the land of enchantment.
Well, was it Berkeley or was it the school? Because theoretical physics, wasn't there a lot?
It was all of it.
There was a lot going on in Berkeley at the time.
I was in love with California at that time. And then I got married about the same time that I arrived, shortly after I arrived in California.
Where did you meet Mary, your wife?
In Philadelphia.
Okay.
We met in Philadelphia toward the end of my May or so of 57, and then I went off to my job, and then she followed me a few months later, and then we got married in California.
Nice.
So our married life begins in California.
And that would be 1958-ish?
Yes, yes. 58 and thereabouts. And so, of course, we had a car, and we did a lot of traveling.
What was Mary doing in Philadelphia at the time?
She was, she had a job as a technician in a medical lab doing medical experiments.
Okay.
She was actually a vivisectionist. They did experiments on mice and rats small animals. So they were studying. What were you studying mice and dogs?
Okay.
She got to be pretty good as an animal surgeon, and then when we came out to Berkeley, she then found a job in the Donner Laboratory of the University of California, Berkeley, which did medical research, and she worked on how the liver works. As studied from in dogs.
Okay. And how long did you guys end up staying there in Berkeley?
How long? We stayed there 13 years. And we left... When did we leave now? We left in the summer of 1970.
Okay.
By that time, I was a full professor at Berkeley. And I was pretty well established there. And in the beginning, I thought that was just wonderful. But then along 1960, it was the Goldwater-Johnson election. When did that take place? I think 1968.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then there was this student revolution at the university, which convulsed the university and the town and eventually spread to other universities across the country. And now that's a long subject in itself, and I don't think it's an appropriate topic.
Yeah, that's a whole nother interview.
That's a whole other topic. there are a great deal of unpleasantnesses. All the sort of hippies and drug addicts and so forth across the country got the word that Berkeley was the place to be. They started infesting it. Berkeley became the bank, the bad check cashing capital of the United States. Mm. And there was a general decline in the whole quality of life.
In those 13 years that you were at Berkeley, did you spend time in the Sierras?
Very often. We would often go to the Yosemite.
Okay.
And do hiking.
Okay.
And things. The closest connection I got to river running is that we once spent a summer at the Jenny Lake Campground at the Teton National Park.
Hmm.
Jenny Lake Campground doesn't exist anymore. They closed. They decided it was imposing on the environment.
Okay.
But Jenny Lake is a beautiful place. We spent time there. We met some people from Salt Lake City, one of whom was something of an entrepreneur, and he had bought 50 fold boats from a Japanese supplier.
Hmm.
And then he was selling them. So we bought two $50 fold boats from him. Do you know what a fold boat
is?
Yes,
absolutely.
It sort of had a wooden frame, and then you had a canvas cover over it, and everything folded down into a compact suitcase of about 30 pounds.
And you bought two of these?
Yeah, but we bought two of these because by that time we had two children.
And what year was this?
This was, I can tell you if I look at, I've got this list of my river trips, and if I look back at that, that was in 1967.
Okay, and so in 67, now you had a lot of canoeing experience, and a full boat
the full boat was something entirely different, of course.
Right,
it's a one-person boat.
Not too dissimilar.
And in 1967, I met these friendly people from Salt Lake City, and I went down the Snake River past the Tetons, and he had his own full boat. And that was my first sort of...
Did Mary have any canoeing or swimming experience as a child?
Yes, she did.
Okay.
And, she was always an outdoor person. She was born and grew up in Honolulu, Hawaii, and her father was a botany professor. And her father always took his students and some members of the family on botany collecting trips on weekends.
Okay.
So she did a lot of hiking and so forth, and I don't know whether she ever had any canoe experience in Hawaii, probably not, but she had a lot of hiking. She used to go hike, she would hike barefoot because she didn't start wearing shoes till she got to high school, actually. A lot of kids in Hawaii were like that.
And did she swim
a lot? No, she corrected me. She says you didn't start wearing shoes. Shoes till eighth grade.
Okay. And did she swim in the ocean a lot?
Oh, yes. Okay. There was a lot of ocean swimming, and their favorite beach was Makapu'u, which had enormous waves.
Wow.
In Hawaii. The Waikiki beach was considered pretty tame by those people.
So you bought these two full boats. You went down the Snake River by the Tetons there in 67. And then where did you go from there with those boats?
Well, we had them in, we brought them back to California. And then we did them in a number of lakes. There are various lakes around California. And we once spent a summer in Colorado at Aspen. And from Aspen, there's some nice lakes. I forget exactly what they were called, but Twin Lakes or something like that. And we took the boat on that. But the idea of river running did not really occur to us seriously. seriously and done that. It was true that when we were, well, after we left California, we moved to Washington, D.C., and then there were a couple of canoeing experiences. My son joined the Boy Scouts, a local Boy Scout group, which was run by a leader who believed that his group should take some sort of wilderness trip every weekend. And we more or less did that. And one of them was a trip down the Cacapon River, which you may not have heard of, in West Virginia. And we had canoes for that. Now, my oldest son, Art, and I went down the Cacapon in... and that was about a 2 or 3 day trip.
Wow. Okay.
That had I would say class 2 and an occasional class 3 rapid.
And did you take the full boats for that?
No, we had the canoes for
okay.
that.
Okay. All right.
Which we had rented from somewhere.
Okay. And what were you doing in D.C. then?
I was first of all in the. Well, you see, I had decided that I was fed up with Berkeley. I decided to quit. That was the second time I had tenure, and I walked away from it. At the same time, I spent a year at the Stanford Physics Department, which had a couple of physicists I was friendly with. They were Sid Drell, and he was the main one. And he was on the President's Scientific Advisory Committee at the time. So he was connected with the Washington scene.
How do you spell Sid's last name?
Drell, D-R-E-L-L.
Thank you.
And he persuaded... I wasn't sure what I wanted to do at that time. So he told me that the U.S. government was about to commence... the strategic arms limitation talks with the Soviet Union, and that actually began to take place in late 1969, and I joined the Arms Control and Disarmament Agency, which was an agency housed in the State Department building under Sid Drell's advice and recommendation, and I was involved in the SALT negotiations for the next number of years until 1976.
Okay.
So I was in Washington from 70 to 76, and I was working first in the Arms Control Agency, and then I graduated to the State Department. I was on the policy planning staff of the State Department, which is sort of the elite group in the State Department. That was a very enjoyable experience.
What years were you working there?
That was
the
whole period was from 1970 to 76. It was the last 2 years in the State Department.
Okay.
This is under Kissinger and Nixon, and we lived through Watergate, and then the coming of President Ford as a successor to Nixon. And this was the years of which the SALT I negotiations were concluded, and then the SALT II period negotiations were continued, and then I left in 1976, and I came to Los Alamos to work at the Los Alamos Laboratory. By that time, that was a fascinating experience. I was a bit disenchanted with... good old Washington politics by that time.
Sure.
I wanted to get back to... So I came back to physics, and I had had an offer some years earlier from the Los Alamos Laboratory.
Can you just recap for me the SALT I and SALT II...
SALT I consisted of two agreements. First of all, there's the anti-ballistic missile... let's see what they were called now. It was the ABM Treaty. The
yep.
ABM, the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty, which I would call a good treaty, which settled the question of whether the two rivals, the U.S. and the USSR, would continue building anti-ballistic missile facilities to counter the nuclear ballistic missiles. There's an awful lot of lore connected with all of that.
Sure.
And then along with that was the so-called interim agreement on offensive missiles, which was a temporary sort of thing with a promise that we would get together after the SALT I agreements were signed to have a definitive set of limitations on offensive nuclear ballistic missiles and nuclear weapons. And then there were three components to that. There were the land-based intercontinental ballistic missiles, the submarine-based ballistic missiles, and then there were the bombs carried by intercontinental bombers.
Right.
And so SALT II came to what was a more or less successful but incompletely successful. And in 1972, and the agreements were signed in about August or September of 1972, and then the SALT II process began after that. And that wasn't completed until the Ford administration was finished, and President Carter had come in, and he completed, under his administration, so the SALT II agreements were eventually signed. And on the one hand, they were fairly successful in several ways. They did set limits on both sides to the arms race, as it was called. On the other hand, there are all sorts of ups and downs and blunders on our side and on the Soviet side, and they weren't quite as good as they could have been from the point of view of a middle-level technician. Yeah, that was the years when Kissinger was running U.S. foreign policy.
Okay. So there's a whole nother interview right there.
yes.
Yeah. So
sure.
So in this time period, from leaving Berkeley in 1970, and then working through, into the Carter administration, 76.
I left before the Carter administration. I left in September of 1976.
Okay.
Carter was elected in 76 and took office in 77.
I'm assuming in that six-year period, a lot of international travel, negotiations.
Yes, I was on the SALT delegation in first of all in Helsinki, and then quite a bit of time in Geneva, where most of the negotiations took place. And there was one six-month period when I had my family with me. We had three children by that time, and so that was an interesting time. And we would go skiing on the weekends, lots of skiing in France from Geneva. It was a nice area for skiing, and then we had some. We traveled a lot around Switzerland, so we and our kids got a good dose of the Swiss mountains and.
Nice.
And Swiss and mostly French skiing.
And I'm assuming, though, correct me out, please, here, that between in that six-year period, 1970, 1976, you weren't doing a lot of full boat work, not a lot of canoeing or river running, more international.
In those days, let's see, in Washington, what did we have? We did this.
You did a canoe trip.
My oldest son, Art, and I did this canoe trip.
Right.
On the Cacapon. My wife, on the other hand, was running a Girl Scout troop.
Ah.
And she organized quite an expedition. She got her Girl Scout troop together, and the parents cooperated, and she had rented a bus, had a bus driver. And the bus made it during the summer. The bus, during the school vacations, the bus made a trip out west.
Wow.
And let's see, you did. You
47 teenage Girl Scouts.
47 teenage.
Wow.
Teenage Girl Scouts.
47?
Parents.
47?
Girl Scouts, yes, on this bus.
That's huge. That's a lot of kids.
This is a 3-week camping trip. Where are you at? You did get as far as the
Tennessee to Tinsley, Wyoming.
All right. She says Washington, D.C. to Tinsley, Wyoming, and back, seeing a lot of the sights.
Wow.
Did you get to the Tetons? I think you did. You did tell. Oh, yes, the Girl Scouts had all sorts of restrictive, protective regulations, so they had to stay in approved campgrounds and approved churches and a synagogue, state parks, national parks. But they had a 3-week outlay. And also, while she was running this Girl Scout troop, they too rented canoes, and you had outings from Washington, D.C. with canoes. So we did have that experience.
Okay, so still doing actually quite a bit of outings, either in the Alps or canoeing and exploring.
It was always vacation trips while we were working in one way or another, but.
So 1977 in Los Alamos.
Came to Los Alamos in the end of August 1976.
Okay.
And so we had our fold boats. And so I had thought of doing rivers with the fold boats. We did spend this summer in Aspen, Colorado. And that's near the Roaring Fork River, which is quite a kayaking stream. I remember talking to some kayaker and telling him about these fold boats. And he sort of threw up his hand. And he said, what you ought to do is go to some of these kayak training sessions that people visit. That'll open your eyes to what it's like. And I'm very glad we didn't try to use the fold boats down the Roaring Fork River, which is really quite a serious class 3 or 4 river.
So Los Alamos had a core group James Fretwell. I'm thinking a number of other people, the Cernicheks, the Maslins, the Yeamans.
That's right. You know a number of the leaders.
Well, their names but there was a big push to explore rivers there. Did you land into that group?
Los Alamos was a hotbed of river running. On the one hand, there was the so-called Explorer Post 20, which had been founded by Fretwell and Bob Amy. That was another name. And then there was Dave Yeamans, who also was important in Grand Canyon activities later on.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a core of maybe half a dozen very active river runners, rafters or kayakers or both. And they founded this Explorer Post 20 for high school boys. And at a certain point, they did admit girls, too. So currently, the post still exists, and it's a boy and girls group.
Okay.
And and they did river running, and they had some large number of, I think, 15, Elan boats, which they bought from... what is the name of this big river company? Oh, God, I'm having a senior moment. Mary, what was our brand name? The Moravia Company had made these 12-foot Elan boats, and the Explorer Post had a fleet of them.
Okay.
And every summer they would do a major trip, so-called, and they had a bus. And so the first year I joined them, the major trip was on the main Salmon River.
Okay.
So we went off on the bus. That was quite educational for me. That was my first real river, and it was a real river under serious conditions.
That was 1977, then?
Let me look at my table here. That was 19. No, the Maine salmon we did in 1980.
Okay.
Oh, excuse me. That was not my first Maine river. Something else happened earlier. We had arrived in Los Alamos at the end of last half of 76. And then there was one of these fluke incidents occurred. Well, no, I was already interested in rivers, as I see from my record here.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't have the fold boats anymore because I had stored the fold boats in my backyard and out in the open. And one day they got stolen.
Oh.
Well, but that wasn't so bad because they weren't appropriate in any case. They were too flimsy for
right.
Class three or more rivers. But I had had some neighbor who was active in using inflatable kayaks, and he told me about sea eagles.
Hmm.
So the first boat I bought in Los Alamos was a Sea Eagle 300, which was an inflatable a one-person inflatable kayak made out of this incredibly strong but not heavy material. I don't remember what their technical name was for it. And then in the Sea Eagle, I started joining various of the active boaters in Los Alamos who were very friendly and took me on and started teaching me what rivers were all about. And in the beginning, we did the Chama, which is a tributary of the Rio Grande. And then one time, we took an ambitious trip down the Dolores, which is a serious Class 3.
Hmm.
But we did that in 1980, and I had a Sea Eagle. There was one raft, and then one canoe, and I guess two kayaks.
So did Mary and the kids go with you?
She didn't. No, I was alone on that trip.
Okay.
But on the various other trips...
What about the salmon, when we went to do the Maine salmon same year?
No, that was in the days when the Explorer Post was all boy.
Oh, okay.
Or men. That was to change. It didn't change until the 1980s.
Did you bring your sons for that?
Yes.
Okay.
My son, Art, he joined the Explorer Post.
Okay.
And then he did that consistently. And see, he was on all their major trips, and
okay.
That's where he learned boating.
Okay.
And then I learned boating as an associate of him. But then there's also this incident in 1970. When was it? 1978. That was an election year, and Senator Pete Domenici was running for re-election of New Mexico. What this got to do with boating is the following. That the SALT negotiations were in progress after I had left, and Senator Domenici wanted to build up his status or his appearance of awareness with foreign policy and with SALT, and he formed a SALT advisory group to advise him. And he picked for the membership of this a couple of people from Los Alamos who were familiar with the weapons program, and then a couple of people from Kirtland Air Force Base who also worked on nuclear weapons, and a professor from the University of New Mexico in Albuquerque called Jay Sorensen, who... He was a political science professor who was also very involved in foreign policy, politics.
How do you spell his
Democratic
name?
Democratic policy. And
how do you spell his name, Chuck?
Jay Sorensen, Sorensen.
Thank you.
So then I got onto this committee. The way I got onto the committee is that Senator Domenici, who was instinctively against SALT, and he was against negotiating with the Russians. But he wanted some credibility in this area since he was running for senator again.
Okay.
And he had a legislative assistant whose name I don't quite remember at the moment. But this guy was more broad-minded, and he was familiar with the activities in Washington and the State Department with the SALT negotiations. So he knew about me, even though I had left a year or two earlier. So he got me onto this committee.
Nice.
So we were there, and we advised Senator Domenici on SALT, which is an uphill battle because he was always against it. But what he wanted the committee to do was tell him why he was against it. But trouble was that Sorensen and I did not go along with that. We were for SALT. And the other people were sort of careful and moderate about that.
Nice.
So he got elected, and then he forgot about the committee. So that was the end of that.
Hmm.
However, I had met Jay Sorensen, and that's J-A-Y.
Okay.
He was an active river runner.
And
he had a group of river runner friends in Albuquerque. And he also had some sort of contact with the Camp Ways rafting company.
Okay.
Camp Ways built a set of very good rafts. They had a 12-foot rubber raft called a Hopi. Then they had a 14-foot Miwok and a 16-foot Shoshone. And Jay had a Shoshone. And he had done a fair number of rivers. And he had a set of buddies in Albuquerque who were with him. And then I met him, and I told him I was interested in river running. So he invited me along, and then he gave me a deal. The Campways company had offered this sort of a deal. They were phasing out their particular Hopi model, and they offered Jay four of their Hopis for $600 each.
Wow.
So I bought one of them, and Jay bought one, and his son bought one, and then there was a fourth one that we sold to my friend at that time, a guy named Pat Blum, who had just come to New Mexico from Arizona, and he had founded a river running outfitter company called the Rio Grande Rapid Transit.
How do you spell his last name?
Pat Blum. B-L-U-M-M.
Thanks.
Yeah, I should have mentioned him before. He was another key entity in the formation of my river running development. What had happened was this. Stretch Fretwell was a promoter. And a very serious outdoorsy guy. He was a mountain climber and a river runner, and he flew his own private plane.
Yes.
He had been all over, and he went helicopter skiing in Canada. He was a bunch of really outdoorsy people, of which he was one of the major ones in Los Alamos. This is a wonderful environment to get interested in the outdoors from.
Hmm.
Anyway, another one of his feats was to found the Pilar Mother's Day races on the Rio Grande. Pilar is a small town on the Rio Grande River at the head of a certain course of Class 3 to Class 4 rapids, which is about... about 12 to 15 miles in length. So it was a short trip. But he organized the Mother's Day races. What that meant was that for the most part rafters, but also kayakers and canoeists would gather together at Pilar for a weekend of racing. There was a raft race. There was a kayak slalom race. There was a kayak. There was a canoe race, and this became quite an event in New Mexico. Some of those years, there were 120 rafts which showed up for the raft race, and it's hard to get 120 rafts to launch on this small river at one time. So they had it staggered, and they counted the times and so forth.
It turned into quite a big deal.
It was a big event. It still is. Mm. And at a certain point, so there's a certain amount of history to river running in New Mexico, which you may
you
get
bet.
Out of me from this
that might
county.
Be another interview here. It's our third interview now of sidetracks.
Okay, yeah, there's a question of river running in New Mexico. But there was, at a certain point, a group of river runners in New Mexico founded the, in Albuquerque, founded the Adobe Whitewater Club.
Right.
Which became the, and still is, the Whitewater Club for all of New Mexico, but with most of its members in Albuquerque and some others in Los Alamos and Santa Fe,
mm-hmm.
and then a few others in other parts of New Mexico. And at a certain point, the stewardship of the Pilar races was turned over to the Adobe Club. Let me see. So I was trying to explain the various ways in which I got introduced to the river. And there was Stretch Fretwell, and there was the Explorer Post. And then the first time that I went to watch the Pilar River races, I met Pat Blum, who had just come to New Mexico from a career in advertising in Arkansas, but he decided that what he really wanted to do was run rivers professionally, and he founded this Rio Grande Rapid Transit Company, which then did ran river trips for tourists down the Pilar section of the Rio Grande and also the Taos Box section and also on the Chama.
Okay.
And so I met him very early, and he gave me a lot of advice on river running. And he also used his river runner, his outfitter status, to buy me my first big boat, which was the Moravia Willowa 2, which I got from Moravia at the wholesale price because of Pat's help.
Nice.
And then there were other, I bought some other river boats later on, more Sea Eagles, which I got at outfitter price through Pat's friend. So he did me a lot of favors then, and he showed me something about it. We went down rivers together.
And was that like 81, 82-ish?
Yes.
Because you'd done the Chama and the Dolores, 1980.
Now, you may have heard about Pat Blum, even though you don't particularly recognize his name. He was the guy who eventually moved his river running outfit back to Arizona, and he was doing the Salt River. And it was employees of his which blew up the Quartzsite Rapid.
Ah.
I remember Pat Blum was a colorful type of entrepreneur. He denied all responsibility for that, but nobody mm-hmm. around New Mexico who knew or believed it. And then there were some other people who were caught.
Right.
And so that's another story.
As you say, Pat was never indicted in any of that activity, but
well, he was certainly under suspicion for that activity. He told people back in New Mexico that he had been polygraphed, and he passed the polygraph of the authorities with flying colors. He denied all knowledge of that.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
So that was another interesting, colorful aspect to river running around here. I remember, maybe this is not directly due to an account of my book biography, but I remember I was sitting in my living room listening to the radio one afternoon, and there was a news broadcast. The news broadcast announced that Quartzsite Rapid on the Salt River had been blown up by dynamite. And so there I was. I thought instantly, God, this must be Pat Blum.
Huh.
So I called up the Tano National Forest River office, and because I wanted them to tell me who was the river rafting outfitter that was involved in this. They refused to give me any information at all. But in due course, it did turn out that it was his company, and it was one of his guides. And then there was one of his guides his guide apparently had a friend who was not a river runner but was an expert in explosives. And the guide and the friend hiked into Quartzsite Rapid carrying some dynamite. And they did what in my opinion, the Forest Service should have done many years ago, is that they converted the Quartzsite Rapid, which is really a killer rapid, and people had died on it, into a nice Class 3 plus rapid. But the appropriate environmental authorities were and the National Forest was outraged at this event and so forth. And then there was a trial and judicial process and so forth. And Platt was not implicated in all of that.
That's right. Let's go back to your boating record, which we kind of left off at the Chama, the Maine Salmon, and the Dolores in 1980. Where did you boat from there?
Well, I was now buddies with Jay Sorensen and his group of people from Albuquerque. And we had an attitude of doing something every week during the boating season.
Okay.
Every weekend. And sometimes we would do the Pilar section of the Rio Grande. Sometimes we would do the Taos Box. The Taos Box is a Class 4, and depending on the flow, veering on Class 5, that's the best stretch of river running from the Albuquerque and close enough to the Albuquerque and Los Alamos areas. And so I did the Taos Box once on with Jay Sorensen on his Shoshone, and he let me do some of the rowing. And so I got some flavor for what the box was like. And then I did the box all on my own. I took one of my adventurous Los Alamos friends along with me, and we actually succeeded. We did it by this time I had the Hopi. And this was one of the high water years. The box was at had gone up to 8,000 CFS, which is enormous for that narrow canyon.
Right.
And then so I did it at 8,000. Then a week later,
what year was that?
7,000. And I might mention, since I'm including my family in this, my son, who had learned rafting on the with the Explorer Post. And he then went to work for an outfitter company called Rio Bravo, which was doing river running on the Taos Box.
Okay.
And he used his our Hopi. So that was pretty adventurous. The manager of the Rio Bravo thing, not the owner, but the guy who was actually on the river, first wanted to test out Art's river running abilities by having Art accompany a commercial trip with Rio Bravo. So he did that. Art did that, and I was his companion on that trip.
And this was 1981-ish?
This was, let's see, it was certainly 1981-ish. Let me think, it might have been, yeah, I think it was about 81.
Okay.
It was about 81. It might have been 80 or 81. Those were high water years. The box was running about 8,000, and that was a ferocious thing.
Yeah,
I remember I was sitting in front of this Hopi, and I would get completely covered with water, and then I kept turning around asking Art, "Are you still there?" Well, he was still there. Anyway, he got the job, and then he had a very successful season with Rio Bravo, but he didn't like their management really, and so the next year he switched to Pat Blum's Rio Grande Rapid Transit, and he did the box for them for several years. He was in high school during this time.
Okay.
and it was slightly illegal. He was underage for the insurance of the that the boater outfitters had for their casualty insurance. But that was all right. Nothing. It worked out okay.
Yeah. So you guys had not done Grand Canyon up to this time?
No. The first time on the Grand Canyon was 1981.
Okay. And how did that trip come together, and who was on it?
Let's see. It worked out like this. There was, and I can mention some names, but you probably are not going to know these names. There was one river runner who I did know, who was on the, whose name was Jim Fuge. Oh, I had met him the previous year because I had done, with my Siegel and with the Sorensen group and with Jim Fuge, I had done Westwater Canyon. Oh, yes, and Art was also on that in his Hopi. And I did it in a Siegel, and Art did it in his Hopi.
This Jim Fuge, is this the Jim that would later fall in Grand Canyon and be helivacked out, or is this his father we're talking about? Is his father named Jim?
I'm talking about a Jim Fuge who was sort of somewhat young, in his 20s in 1979.
Okay, got it.
How does that compare with...
That's the son, sure.
Yeah. Okay, so he was an active river runner.
Mm-hmm.
And so one day I got a phone call from another guy named Jim Beard, who was living in Colorado at that time, and who I had not known before, but he was a friend of Jim Fuge.
Okay, and can you spell the two Jim's last names?
Jim Fuge was F-U-G-E.
Thank you.
And Jim Beard was B-E-A-R-D.
Thank you.
Now, Jim Beard was a colorful character on his own right, and as I was eventually to learn. What he had called me up, and this was in 1981, spring of 81, because Jim Fuge had recommended me. And what happened was that Jim Beard had gotten a permit to do the Grand Canyon.
Huh.
Fuge, for some reason, was not able to go at that particular time. And Jim Beard was completely new to river running. He had bought a Udisco from some friend, a used Udisco. Udiscos were a rafts which was fairly common in the early 1980s. They were made of some sort of neoprene rubber, and they were not very good. Or they had a reputation of tearing very easily. Anyway, he had gotten one, and he was determined to do the Grand Canyon. He had never done any river at all before that.
Okay.
However, he did know the Grand Canyon. The reason he knew the Grand Canyon is that he was living in Colorado. Let's see, what was he doing in those days? I think he was a truck driver, and he had a job driving a water tank truck for some of the oil and gas companies who needed an awful lot of water to run their gas and oil wells.
Okay.
For some reason. And he would take this huge truck, which carried a huge amount of water, and fill it up somewhere and then deliver it to the gas and oil sites. Anyway, but he was a hiker.
Ah.
And he had done a lot of hiking in the Grand Canyon. And among other things, he had hiked in this way. He would hike from some rim down to the river. He would then hitchhike. He would hitchhike with some commercial trip, which would take him some miles down the river, and then he'd get off, and he'd hike back. And he had a number of years of doing this.
Hmm.
And he didn't have much money, so he didn't pay the commercials anything, but they would give him chores.
Okay.
He would do the porta-potties.
Sure.
And he would do the simple chores, so he was very helpful for that. So he knew a fair amount of the Grand Canyon. He had hiked all of Nankoweap, for example.
Hmm.
From the rim down to the water. And well, I'm not sure if it was. Is this right? Can you get from the rim down to the water easily?
Yeah, neck weep. Well, not easily. I mean, it's a long walk, but you can absolutely do it.
Okay, yeah. So he did multi-week trips hiking with his backpack and hitchhiking there. So then he applied for a Grand Canyon River trip permit, and as you recall, the questionnaire requires that the applicant list his previous river experience on rivers comparable to the Grand Canyon.
Right.
Because they didn't want any amateurs going down.
Right.
He had never done anything. But what he did was wrote down that he had worked as an assistant boatman on the Grand Canyon.
Got it.
Because he had done some assistant boating on some pieces of the Grand Canyon. Anyway, he turned out to be a very tough guy, and he did all right on the Grand Canyon.
Is he still alive?
So on this trip...
Hey, Chuck.
I'm sorry?
Hey, Chuck, is Jim still alive?
He's still alive. I haven't talked with him for a number of years. There was a certain point where he moved from Colorado to near Monticello in Utah, and he built his own house there. And then he had bought a series of 16-foot boats, or 15-foot, 9-inch boats. There's a difference for Arizona, you know, because on a 16-foot boat, you have to carry a Class 4, a Type 4 throwable cushion, and that's a pain in the neck. Well, man, all right. And he became my buddy.
Okay.
And most of my Grand Canyon River trips were done with him.
Okay.
And on most of my Grand Canyon River trips, Mary, my wife, came along also, and Jim had a collection of friends. And for this trip, let's see, it was quite a crowd. It was Mary and I, that was two of us, then it was Jim and his friend Dave Rydell, then there was my friend Dick Flansky, and then there was Pete Beard, who is Jim Beard's brother, and then there was another guy from Flagstaff who was a friend of Jim's, and then there were two other people who I recruited, and a whole list of other people. He had a bunch of friends who did not do the whole trip. Some of them left at the Tanner Wash hike out.
Okay.
And others joined the Tanner. And then some came in at the Phantom Ranch, and others left at Phantom Ranch.
Oh, okay.
And we sort of tooled along that way with some coming and going. And we eventually got down to Pierce Ferry.
Oh, you took out at Pierce. Okay.
Some of us took out at Pierce.
Okay.
And so forth. And that was an interesting trip. I did have one real problem. Mary and I had one real problem in our Moravia, at Hans Rapid. This was 1981. It was before the 83 flood, and Hans Rapid was different from it was after the flood.
Okay.
And at the time we were going at the flow, we were doing it, the river, I would say, was looking very fierce.
Hmm.
And it was not particularly clear that there was any good way to do it. The best entrance seemed to be on River Right, but there was a huge hole if you just followed down on River Right.
Right.
And on River Left, there were some rocks and other problems on early at the entrance. Yeah, something like that. So I remember what my plan was, which was to enter on River Left, and then when I got halfway down, to ferry like mad to to enter on River Right, which wasn't so bad.
Okay.
And then to ferry like mad to River Left.
Yep.
And there was some noticeable rock, sort of center left.
Mm-hmm.
And that was our objective. If I could ferry over to River Left above that rock, then I could. I had clear boating down the rest of the rapid.
Okay.
So that was my plan. And it didn't work. What happened was that I, with enormous effort, ferried over and did make it and did make the turn around the rock, at which point I was pretty tired. And somehow the river took over, and the river brought me back to square one. It brought me right above the huge hole. So we entered the hole with no forward momentum. So that was a problem. We got stuck in the hole.
Ooh.
And so we were stuck in the hole, and then the boat turned sideways. So Mary and I both leaned forward toward the downriver side, trying to keep the balance of the rapid of the raft, and then the rapid kept jostling us about.
Right.
And then somehow the rapid turned us around, so that the other side was facing downstream. So we moved to the other side and faced downstream. And while this was happening, the water was pouring over us. It was tearing various things apart. It ripped. I had two spare oars, and I had what I thought was a clever way of attaching them to the boat so that I could get at them instantly.
Mm-hmm.
This is going to be a bit of a tedious story, perhaps. It's going to take a couple more minutes.
It's all right.
It was a bad experience. But I gave some thought before the trip as to how I should attach my spare oars to the side of the boat so that if I lost one of the main oars, I could grab the spare oar very quickly. And my scheme was to attach some tension cord in a certain way to the D-rings on the side of the boat, wrap the tension cord a number of times around the spare oar, and then with a clip to attach it to the center D-ring. So the oars were there, held onto the boat by tension cord. And I practiced releasing the clip and grabbing the oar. And I could do that very quickly. So I thought that was a good idea.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't a good idea because the tension cord is pretty weak compared with the force of the water.
Right.
But both, and while we were in this, trapped in this hole for a significant amount of time, with the boat turning itself around, different sides at different times facing downriver, the river tore both spare oars off the boat and downstream.
Right.
Then another thing the river did was bend the upstream oar, which was in an oar lock. This was, it was an oar. It bent it at right angles.
Okay.
Then the next thing that happened is that Mary wasn't in the boat anymore. So that really worried me.
Yep.
She had apparently been grabbed by the river and pulled over the side of the boat on the upstream side.
Wow, okay.
Because it wasn't all that upstream. The boat was tilted.
Yes.
So shortly after that, and then what happened was that Mary was pulled underneath the boat. Well, she's sort of a calm, not excitable person, fortunately. And she was under the boat, and what she did was sort of palm her way downstream, and eventually I sighted her downstream of the hole.
Okay.
And about this time, the boat itself was pretty well filled with water, and the rapid decided to release the boat. So both Mary and I were sort of released from the rapid at about the same time, and we were floating down. And the boat was full of water, and I had only one oar, and so I got Mary back at the boat. And then we just floated down. And, there was an eddy on the right side, and we somehow floated into this eddy. So that part was okay.
Mm.
And then one of the oars, that we had lost was floating in the Seine eddy.
Ooh.
So we got back one oar. And then the boat was full of water, so we had to bail. This was in the pre...
couple hundred gallons there, maybe?
I estimated it had 2 tons of water.
Okay, sure. And we've just lost the call here with Chuck Zemach. Today is the, where are we at here? It's the 13th of January, Tuesday morning, and so I'm going to terminate this, and we'll call Chuck back.